shop.
This is some new technology. anyway, you guys were asking about logos. So up here, in a convenient little diamond shape, is the new graphic object identifier for the physiology department at Hopkins. I'm not allowed to use the word logo. But anyway, so I just moved to Johns Hopkins a year ago, but this is all work that I've started in my postdoc with Tom Duffy, who is at Princeton University. And what's really cool about all these projects is that they're huge projects where we go use user facilities, and these user facilities are built and maintained by national lab scientists from all over the world, actually. And so none of this, anything that we do, is nothing is possible without the collaborators we have at Lawrence Livermore National Lab and the Omega affiliate University of Rochester, which is why I have so many logos attached. I should start wearing them as badges on my clothes to whenever we go. But I wanted to talk about some really cool experiments that I've gotten interested in the past couple of years and want to continue working on, you know, as my as my group progresses, because our new ability in the past couple of years to be able to reach pressures and temperatures that correspond to those in the interiors of exoplanets is really exciting. When I used to think about dynamic compression and shock compression, it was always, you know, in my mind, I had this image of old white men in basements with guns. And only those that had expensive toys could actually access, you know, high pressures and temperatures. But now, because of these user facilities and because of the nature of how laser compression allows you to have more diagnostics pointing at your sample, it seems like, you know, there's really a whole, you know, a whole new frontier of possibilities of being able to study. And so it's actually quite exciting. This is a picture from one of our experiments. This is actually an in situ picture with no extra lighting. All the light is produced by the plasma that's created. And so there's a big bright spot here. So this is where all of the laser beams hit a metal foil to create X-rays. That's our X-ray source. And that's the brightest spot. There's a few laser beams that are also pointing to a sample, which is connected to about a couple centimeter sized box. So this is larger than life right here. But so this small plasma spot is what drives the sample to high pressure. We focus laser beams onto a sample. That turns into plasma. The plasma expands. And as the plasma is expanding backwards, a pressure wave will go through our sample. And so these two bright sources of light are the plasmas that we create. And then these are all spectrometers that are pointing in to be able to watch what's going on. And we have our X-ray diffraction box here, which is how we collect what structure is. And in the back is another camera for skew and interferometry. So I'll show a sketch of this later, but I really like starting with the picture because it's really an amazing facility that we go to. All right, so where do we start? So I wanted to start with a zoomed out picture of how we think about planetary evolution and planetary science. And I know that this is something that we've talked about over the past couple of weeks, but when we think about, you know, how all of the material properties are connected, we want to be able to connect what we observe on the Earth's surface or the planetary surface and be able to explain it in terms of the planet's history and evolution. And so all of this is tied together by the material properties, the mineral physics properties of minerals at high pressure. And this is where we, mineral physicists, come in, where we actually go in and measure the properties that we claim, that we think are the most important ones that, that you guys need to model. And so this is where we turn to the modelers to say, what is it really, you know, what do you want us to measure? And we can start with things like the phase diagram, the equation of state that controls, you know, what minerals are down there and what the compressibility is, what the density is at high pressures. But what we really would like to eventually get towards is measuring the dynamical properties, and so the how fast heat propagates through a material, what is the strength of the material at these super extreme conditions. And so, you know, as the experiments get more complicated, there are a lot more caveats, but we have a lot more access potentially to kinetic properties as well, potentially. So this is whenever we think about, you know, the types of things that we're measuring, we really are trying to connect it to the observations and connect the whole planet together. But, you know, it really comes down to what happens to a mineral when you squeeze it, and why does it do that? So if we think about things like super Earth, about terrestrial planets that are bigger than our Earth, we really are using our own planet as a reference frame. And so sometimes I'll describe this as using Earth as an analog for other planets. But when we think about what could we predict at super high pressures, what happens to the same building blocks of our planet when we think about how we build other planets, we can start with the same starting materials, where we start with a planet and ask the question, what happens if we bring together iron, magnesium, silicon, oxygen, a little bit of nickel, and what minerals would they form? And as we look outwards from our own solar system, we can start to think, what would actually bodies out there look like? What would their properties be if we started with the same fundamental starting materials? So if we start with oxide silicates and iron metal or iron alloy metals, we can see that just by looking at the phase diagrams of predictions of higher pressure minerals, we would go through some really important phase transition. What's interesting is that for the core, we actually still argue over what the crystal structure is of iron metal in our own core. And of course, that's still the same question as we look onto to bigger planets. For the mantle, things are a little bit more interesting, where NGO is one big building block. In our Earth, it's not that interesting. But in super Earth, it goes through a phase transition. And there could be a difference in viscosity across this phase transition, a big change in properties that allow us to have something like a layered convection in a mantle rather than just a whole mantle that's convecting. And we know this phase diagram based on analog studies, based on DFT calculations, and it's just now we're starting to get the point where we can actually start accessing these pressures and temperatures ourselves, which is also really exciting. And so if we're aiming for an Earth size, or a super Earth that's 10 times the size of Earth, we're going to need to get to over 1,000 GPa to be able to even reach the conditions of the core, which is mind-boggling, but is now possible because of lasers. It's really exciting. Okay, so we learned a bit about shockwaves last week in Sarah's talk, and so I want to do just a few quick, say some quick notes about this technique of shock compression. So I'm viewing it as more of a way to access super high pressures and temperatures, not just asking the questions of what happens when two planets slam into each other and how do they form another planet. This is taken from a textbook where basically we look at the properties of material when a very powerful energy wave goes through it. And so shockwaves, I once had a mentor that defined it as the material's response to impacts and explosions. And that's really the fundamental of it. Whenever you slam a material with either a bullet or a big laser or blow something up, the speed at which the shockwave moves through the sample will be a reflection of the material's properties. And each time you hit a material, you'll map out a locus of states called the Hugonio. And so just by the equations of the conservation of mass, momentum, and energy, we can then actually calculate exactly what is the pressure and the density at a compressed state if we can measure things like the particle velocity and the shock velocity. So you have three unknowns, some of your starting parameters, and then by measuring a few of the other ones, we can then calculate exactly what the internal energy is, for example. So this maps out a series of states. But what if we wanted to access states that are not on the Hugonio? One of the issues with these gun experiments early on was that, as you want to start to things like the core, by the time we get to those pressures with the gun, every material that we're interested in is already molten because it's already too hot. All of the energy is converted into heat. So there's a few ways around it. One thing we can do is hit a sample twice, so have two following shock waves, one after another, or have an implosion where you have a shock wave coming from one side or another side. So either way, instead of just hitting a sample once, you can actually do a bounce, where it travels up to one state, and then on the second shock, it travels up to another state. This depiction here is a bit of a simplification because even though we can go from one state to the next, the material properties, once you're already in the high-pressure state, are actually slightly different. And so instead of actually bouncing onto the same Hugonio, it's a slightly different one. But anyway, for illustration purposes, this is the way we can draw it.
June, there's no time information on this plot, but presumably after you get to that condition, you drop back down.
That's a really good question, yeah. And so
the second shot comes in very fast.
That's a really good question. So the way that we draw these is that we We assume that the material is still at the high pressure state when the second one comes back through. If a material were then for first to come up here and then have time to relax down again and then get shocked again, that would again be a different Hugonio as well. And so whenever we draw these diagrams, we are operating on the assumption that that when a shockwave passes through a sample, the rise time depends on the material properties itself, and it's usually on the order of a picosecond, and so it depends on the material. But then, you know, how long you can hold that high pressure state depends on how long can you hold your source. And so, you know, for one thing I'll get into in a second, is that laser experiments are extremely short. Our laser pulses are on the order of at most 10 nanoseconds. And so if you're going to do a double shock, you better do those right after each other. Otherwise, the material's going to release before you can do the second one. It's a lot easier with guns. You have microseconds. And so time scale becomes a big issue where we argue over, do you have enough time to actually achieve the state that you want to be able to study and have it hold there in order to be able to assess its properties? Yeah.
I have a dumb question. Does the material actually progress along the solid line or the dashed line? Is it the core or the...
So these are the states that we achieve, and what this is called the Rayleigh line, and this is the actual state that the material travels upwards to land there. And so if you hit a material twice, you reach the same final pressure, but the thermodynamic path that you take skips over, and of course if you integrate underneath this, you get the energy, and so you really avoid a lot of extra waste heat by hitting a material twice. And so this is a way to think about how we can actually access different states in the PT diagram by, you know, successive jumps. So if you think about, you know, just hitting at something once, hitting something twice, if we go to the far other end of the limit, this is actually what we describe when we're talking about ramp compression, where instead of hitting material at once, you slowly bleed in the energy, and slowly is a relative term, the slope has to be shallow enough that your wave is not steepened into a shock wave. And that shallowness depends on material properties again. So this is, you know, we have to really learn a lot more about material properties and strength before we can actually get to the point where we just tune and create our own laser pulse shape. But this is definitely a big active area of research. And so if you put in a ramp shape in the material, you will not achieve shock compression, and you can actually quasi-isentropically compress at high pressures. I have a better figure showing this. This is often a way that people will show how we can get to extreme states. So this is temperature down here on the inside axis. Density is so more dense going that way, more higher pressure going up that way. And so if you start at zero and you shock compress the material, you jump to different areas on this Hugonio, this red line, this Hugonio. But if you isentropically compress, it follows what's this blue curve right here. And so what we do in ramp compression is we don't know the exact loading path often, because that will depend on the strength of the material. So whatever dissipative effects allow the energy to not all be converted into temperature, controls how far away from the isentrope we go, but we are very close to the isentrope in terms of density. And so this is the technique that we use, is without using a shock wave, we try to get to as high pressure as we can without melting the sample. And so this is how we can tune where we get to in some sense by the loading path. Okay, a quick aside. These experiments are all possible because there are these amazing laser facilities that are out there. There is, of course, there's also a large facility in New Mexico where using magnets, you can actually slam these big plates into each other. And so those are, you know, driven by magnets and allows you to also tune the actual path. But the highest pressures that we can achieve are achieved because of these large lasers, and these are built for the fusion energy project, and these are built to study atomic bombs. And so this is all funded by DOE, and we get to come along with our rocks and stick them on there and use these amazing lasers to drive them to really high pressures and use the technology that's been developed to study these extreme conditions, to study fusion and be able to bring materials to really high pressure. And so we're really lucky. Okay, so how does this work? I mentioned this a little bit. We focus a bunch of lasers onto the back of a sample. That expands this direction. The pressure waves goes in the other direction. And really, you know, the technology has been progressing so quickly in lasers that it's really allowed us minophysicists to access higher and higher pressures. And this is really cool. The pressure limit of what could be experimentally achieved for a long time was set by diamond cell experiments, but now because of lasers, we can get to higher and higher pressures. Actually, there are more facilities around all the time. Because the laser technology is getting better, there are tabletop lasers that can bring you to 100 GPa easily in the basement of your own lab. There are different laser systems that can be paired with X-rays or paired with synchrotrons to be able to probe more properties during this compression state. And so really there's an explosion of opportunities out there, pun intended. Okay, so what are some of the things that we can do? This is one example of a study that we did where we used a ramp compression wave to study the equation of state of iron. So by putting this unknown path of ramp loading into a material that has the exact same load, but is built so that it has different steps, we can look at when does the actual wave arrive at each step surface and then measure and propagate backwards that difference. And by comparing all these steps at the same time, we can then extract out what is the density response of an input pressure derive. And that's what we're measuring by measuring this equation of state. And so if we know, if we fit a strength model to this, we can actually calculate exactly the equation of state. But what we're really measuring is the pressure, the density response. This is a diagram showing what's called a hole realm. This was a technology that was classified until not too long ago, which is kind of cool, where this is actually how they bring this to really high pressure in this fusion experiment. They shoot all these laser beams inside of a gold capsule. The gold capsule then, the gold starts turns into a plasma and starts irradiating X-rays. And all of these X-rays then will actually hit the back of the sample, which turns that into a plasma. And so it's almost like a Rube Goldberg experiment, where it's this, it's that, but the result is a super smooth, consistent pressure drive that's hitting your sample. Some other things that we can do. Oh, so the experiments that I've been focusing on have been at not the National Institute facility, which is where the highest pressures can be achieved, but this is the second biggest laser system in the world, the Omega Laser in Rochester. And so this is at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics in Rochester. And there's actually two laser systems here. And I recently gave a talk on this where I made a joke that I think it's about the size of a football field, but I don't really know because I don't know how big a football field is. Apologies to those of you that heard that joke twice, but they're really humongous, and there are multiple lasers that are in parallel brought up to energy, and then what's really amazing about them is that their precision of both timing and focusing is so great. They can actually deliver up to a kilojoule over 7 nanoseconds in a tiny focal spot with a precision of a couple, I think it's plus or minus 10 picoseconds. That's crazy, and that's what's required in these really high-pressure experiments. And so it's an incredible laser. What's crazy, though, that picture I showed you before, only 6 of the 50 beams are pointed at the sample to drive it to high pressure. The rest were pointed at the X-ray source to create these X-rays. And so you can imagine what kind of pressures you could achieve when you're putting it all into the sample rather than into the X-ray drive. So these are the two main diagnostics. Well, again, as I mentioned, we put most of our lasers on the X-ray source, and then we have a box that is attached to the sample. The sample goes right here, which measures the X-ray diffraction patterns. We put image plates inside, so these are a couple centimeters long, to measure the X-ray diffraction pattern. And then we also use velocimetry. So we look at the speed of a propagating surface, whether it's a reflecting shock wave or it's a boundary marker within your sample that you can then watch the speed of. And that's how we determine our pressure, by looking at the change in velocity.
So June, what Doppler shift is a light source that you're applying to this?
So we'll shine a green laser at it, okay. And then it'll come back. Yeah, and so with interferometers, you can actually look at really small changes in velocity over a very short period of time. So when a ramp wave is applied into the sample, we use this interesting trick where we can actually start using, we can put in a laser pulse shape without knowing the equation of state of the material that we're trying to study, because we're trying to understand unknowns. And so if we know the equation of state or the pressure response of a material that sandwiches our sample, then we can take advantage of that and know what pressure we're getting to. And so diamond's been studied before. It's a very strong material. And so what we did was we sandwiched a iron silicon alloy of unknown equation of state in between two diamonds. As you apply a ramp compression wave into it, there's the impedance contrast across these is different enough that as soon as you have a couple of bounces, the pressure equalizes. And so we can take advantage of this thin foil technique to be able to bring our sample up to a known pressure if we're measuring the velocity response of the diamond, and then bring our sample to high pressure without and be able to measure the pressure of the diamond surface, extrapolate back to our sample, we know what pressure this is. So this is a detail that's really important when you're studying things that you don't know the pressure response of. So this is the technique to take advantage of. At the same time, as I mentioned before already, we have a laser spot size. This is about 800 microns. Our sample that we measured the x-rays through were about 300 microns. And so at the same time as the sample is being driven to this high pressure and then held there for a while, we turn on our x-ray source for 1 nanosecond. And so the whole experiment is over in about 10 nanoseconds, but the pressure hold period is about 1 to 2 nanoseconds. You can actually tune the energy of the x-rays that we use by using different metal foils. And so getting a higher and higher energy source is difficult, and that's what we need to be able to cut through all of the x-ray laser or all the x-ray background that's produced by these plasmas. And so it's a cool development to be able to use new sources that that have only started to be developed for other experiments. Okay, so this is a bit what the data looks like. So on top here, this is a compression drive that we stitched together. So you can see it looks a bit lumpy because we put a little foot. We have we assemble this ramp drive by putting together different laser pulses, and those are then stitched together to create a ramp pulse. Even though it's bumpy, it's okay because as the ramp wave goes through the sample, it smooths out. And so by the time it reaches our material, especially with all the different reflections and bounces going around, it's going to be at a constant pressure. And then we have a very similar pulse just for our x-rays. And so our x-rays are timed to turn on when the peak pressure is occurring in our sample. And so we make sure that all the timing lines up by looking at this velocimetry and extrapolating that backwards. So this is what the data itself actually looks like. These are X-ray diffraction patterns measured during the peak hold time of our compression experiment. And so all these colorful lines here are the pinhole lines that we use to calibrate the location of the detectors. Those are actually the same pinhole that cuts out all the extra X-rays. And we can see here that we were studying an iron silicon alloy with 78% silicon. That's a reasonable amount for a core composition. And we can see these three diffraction lines here correspond to the hexagonal close-packed phase structure of iron alloy. And at super high pressures, we can see that the two peaks, the two brighter peaks carry on, but the lighter one is in between the two is too faint to see, but it's still in the same structure. You can see other dots here, for example, those come from our windows, and so those are all things that we have to make sure that we can account for when we look at these experiments.
Is this typical for how sharp those diffraction lines are?
This is a very nicely done experiment.
That must be tremendous uncertainty then.
So there is a bit of a, and you'll be able to see also, the uncertainty in terms of despacing is much less than the uncertainty in terms of pressure, and so we don't notice it as much. What is interesting, so like the thickness of the lines here are actually controlled by the size of your pinhole. And so if you, in some sense, you want to have a bigger pinhole because then you can get more x-rays on your sample, but then your peaks are going to be not as well resolved, and so sometimes it's hard to see them. And so, but they have no relation to the thickness of these lines themselves, because the actual, these are diffracting off of a corner of ambient pressure material, and so that's all determined by the optical depth of the X-rays through your sample. And so it's a game that we have to play, and it's actually, we've had to play around with a bit where we try to actually, you know, make the size bigger. And so it's, you know, we're fighting the fact that there's a huge X-ray background. Actually, when you use a plasma to drive your sample, the X-ray background scales to the fourth with pressure, and so it's a huge problem. And so these reach the highest pressure that we were able to achieve. And so this is actually the world record right now for the highest pressure diffraction pattern, 1,314 GPA. And that's only because we switched to using this germanium backlighter, you know, this germanium source, which emitted at a much higher energy, which we were able to then use to cut out the laser plasma background.
So how do we determine the pressure?
Okay, so the pressure is determined by measuring the velocity of the ramp wave going through the diamond. And so if you measure the velocity of the ramp wave going through the diamond, that can then be, you can then use that to extrapolate backwards to the sample diamond interface. And so it's because someone else before had measured the pressure response of diamond under ramp compression on a different experiment. And so those pressure density responses can only be measured on NIF, because those are the places where you can do the stepped targets. And so it's because we have a standard to compare to, we can then extrapolate backwards. But there's huge error bars because we don't know the strength model very well. And so I'll show that in a second. Yeah?
How large is the X-ray spot size, and how big are the gradients within that X-ray spot?
That's a really good question. So the X-ray spot size in the end turns out to be about 300 microns is the size of the window. But then the laser that we're focusing on the sample, as I mentioned, is 800 microns. And so you have to design your experiment so that you have no side waves, you know, coming in. And that's different for different materials. And so it's really important to have a much bigger spot size. And then this is actually really important when doing different kinds of laser experiments attached to X-ray sources, where, you know, with an X-ray laser, you can actually, you know, do a similar experiment instead of having to use this pinhole technique. And often people will design experiments where the spot size of the material, you know, on the material is so small that you're always sampling, you know, gradients. And so it's a really important consideration that is, that needs to be considered more in many different experiments.
Do you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So did you ramp through 130 GPA to 1300 GPA in one experiment?
No, so these are multiple shots.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you've got two different X-ray diffractions.
Yeah. So let me show just a few more patterns, and I'll show the end. So this is, I guess this is exactly what you're asking. Okay, so this is the two different patterns, and then these are each of the diffraction points. We have large errors in pressure, as I mentioned, because we don't know the strength model of the diamond window very well. There's actually a few different studies, one using shock and one using ramp, where one claims that as you are dynamically compressing diamond, the strength immediately goes away, and you can assume that it's hydrostatic. There's another that shows that the strength is maintained. We just don't know the answer, and there are so many people that are trying to study this, because how energy is dissipated into the material is really important for determining what the energy balance is. And of course, that's what we want to know when we're talking about processes in the Earth, for example. And so there's a lot of people interested in figuring out how do we, as a function of strain rate even, look at the strength of the material. And so these are all different shots. The shots are all, these shots each took about 45 minutes to take. And you go to, these facilities, and you get maybe 10 to 14 shots in one visit. And so they run the whole, so the whole laser itself is run by maybe 30 people on a shot day, where it's they crew it like a ship. And most of the guys that work there are actually from the Navy, which is also really funny too. And so there's a shot director, and then there's two people that are aligning the lasers, two people aligning the visor, two people that are in charge of this. You talk to people who are loading up, the different samples, and it's this, this huge operation just to get these few data points. So let's see. Okay, so we did this with 7.8%. We saw that was HCP. Yes, so another question.
The analog on high pressure looks a little weird.
That's a good question. Yeah, so so from 500 GPA or so upwards, we were using two diamond windows on either side. And depending on the strength model, it gives us asymmetric error bars because we assume that it maintains strength, but then the lower limit is 5 if we use a no strength model. And so it's because we don't know the strength model of diamond that we have asymmetric error bars. And so we try to consider all the different sources of unknowns. And if we think about that too much, we think, oh gosh, we actually don't know anything. But we do know reasonably well, I would say, that, well, these are nice and generous error bars, but it's also really important to recognize that, even though we are achieving these super high pressures but we don't know the actual state very well, but what's cool is that once someone actually, does a systematic study, if we ever figure out how to measure what the exact strength response is, this data is still there, and so we can go in and correct the error bars to be able to know exactly what the pressure is. And so this is an example of why it's really important to make sure that all of the metadata is captured with the actual experiment itself, so that we can come back in and still use the same data and really know what the response is. And so that's a different way. What's actually also cool too is that if we squint at this, so I mean this is mostly a guide to the eye because there are so few points, but if we fit a Vinet equation of state through this, which is has its own caveats, we really are falling right on top of all of these dashed lines here are actually extrapolations of isotherms measured from diamond cell experiments, which only make it up to a couple hundred GPA. And so all of these have been measured and extrapolated, and it's actually not that different from the equation of state that we're achieving here. And so, really, one might look at this and say, well, there's no point in doing these laser compression experiments if all you have to do is extrapolate from diamond cell. Well, that's a negative way to think of it. I mean, really the actual phase is really an important result here. This technique is more about knowing what the phase is rather than knowing what the density response is. But it's cool to be able to see that everything that we're doing as mineral physicists, they all are consistent with each other. We can actually come up with similar answers. So that's really cool. Let's see. Okay.
Maybe we'll move. Can we move to the conclusions?
Sorry. Okay. I'll skip over this one. If we did 15.8%, we only see the DCC structure. La la la. Okay. So I'll just end on this one here, where if we take the results and stick them into Burnman, we can build planets and ask questions like, what happens if you have a core that has a certain amount of silicon in it? What does that mean in terms of our interpretation of the core metal boundary radius and the pressure in the interior? So creations of states of metal alloys are really important. And another point I wanted to make in the end was that we can make estimates for the temperature path that we achieve based on models of the strength of the material and knowing the Hugonio, but really we don't know much except for the fact that we're in the solid and not melting in liquid because we have a diffraction pattern. And so there's a lot of work to be done to be able to know exactly what we're studying. Okay, that's all. Thanks.
Let's take a few more questions.
So you're not trying to measure temperature at all in these experiments?
Right? So in these experiments, we cannot measure temperature.
Is there a path to doing so for such high compression?
You can measure the temperature emitted at a shock front, but that's a shock wave that's moving through your sample by doing pyrometry. That's hard to do, and that's something people are working on. There are some that claim that integer Raman is the only way to truly get the temperature. There are some experiments where people try to measure the excess pattern and try to fit the Debye-Waller factor from that. So there's a few different ways, but it really is one of the holy grails, is trying to actually measure the temperature so that we don't have to use a heat capacity model to get that from the actual material itself. Yeah, Max.
Is data from the shockwaves generally consistent with computational mineral physics?
Um, So at these extreme pressures, I would say, well, it depends on your scale. Like, for example, if you think about MgO, we do agree that there is an MgO B1, B2 transition, but that within different calculations, there's a huge discrepancy in more than 100 GPA over the pressure of that. And so I think that the scatter within the experiments is definitely less than the scatter within the DFT, if that's not saying much. I would say that because we're pushing the envelopes, we really only have DFT to compare it to sometimes. And so it's not much different than I think in the past when we were trying to figure out even what, you know, what is the transitions that occur. And so it's, so yes is an answer to a degree. Yeah.
This must be a very dumb question. You know, I can really understand that when you have a bullet, you know, doing something, there's a shock with the inertia of the mass. But for a laser, I mean, there's not much mass, so why is there a big pressure?
So if you think about how dense a solid is versus how dense a gas is, if you convert solid to plasma, you're having a huge expansion. And so that very rapid expansion is what's driving the compression in the other direction. Yeah.
So how do the uncertainties in the equation of state compare with the extrapolated uncertainties from the DAX study?
So that's the question that we cannot answer because in DAX studies, we don't always have all information about the correlated uncertainties. So if you are generous with your estimate of uncertainty, then there's this huge window and we're always on top of it. And this is why, even though we're isentropically with a little bit more temperature compressing, we're really most of the time within uncertainty just consistently isotherm. So that's a good question.
So June's going to be here for the rest of the meeting. Excellent. See you.